introduce our first speaker, and I had the privilege of hearing him, so get ready for John T. to share his experience, strength, and hope. Come on, John.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I am a member of the Pathway to Power group. We meet up in Yonkers on Wednesdays and Saturdays. We are an enthusiastic bunch. Come check us out. And a special shout out to Sunday 103, from whom we stole their format and have found a way to perfect it. So thank you, 103. It is a privilege and an honor to be speaking in front of you today, celebrating our 81st anniversary. And for anybody who's new or just coming back, or you just don't know what we're really celebrating, you know, besides the fact Dr. Bob's last drink and the formation of our fellowship, what we're really celebrating is the fact that 81 years ago, Bill Wilson's business deal fell through. That's really the whole thing right there. Had it been a success, he never would have looked for an alcoholic to help, right? He would have never found Dr. Bob, and they never would have went on to be co-founders of this fellowship. And we probably wouldn't be here today, you know? So it makes me think about in my life whenever I have a reversal of fortune, bad luck, things don't go my way, things fall apart, worst day of my life. I never know when that might be a blessing in disguise. You know, the kind of blessing in disguise that just might change my whole life. And in this case, in Alcoholics Anonymous case, the lives of countless other people. So it's a miracle that we're here. And so speaking of failures, my story, I don't have a lot of time up here, so I'm going to give you a brief sketch of my history. My story, I'll start with my first drink. I was 13 years old. It was summertime. I knew that there was going to be a softball game at the field. Nobody was home, and I had a plan. And the plan was, I'm going to go into the liquor cabinet, and I'm going to get some booze. Turned out to be rum, and I'm going to drink it, and I'm going to see what happens. I was going to that field. I knew that there were going to be older kids there. Some kids that I didn't know so well, and I had that old familiar anxiety that a lot of us know about, like, are they going to like me? Am I going to fit in? Is it going to be okay? And I didn't know that that's what that anxiety was about, but that's what it was about. And I started walking to that field, and before I was halfway there, I'm taking pops off the rum. I wasn't walking anymore. I was floating. And something happened to me that I hear people sometimes describe it in AA as like their first spiritual experience. And for me, it was very much like that, the first time I got drunk. By the time I got to that field, man, that anxiety was gone. They were lucky that I was there. You know, I felt like I was around my best friends, you know, of my whole life. And I'll tell you the truth, I still don't remember ever playing softball that day. I don't. And by the time I got home, my mother was home. I got sick. I got caught. I got yelled at. I got grounded. But you know what? The next day, when I went over the events that happened in my mind, and I thought about that, I didn't think about getting sick, getting caught, getting yelled at, and getting in trouble. That was a small price to pay for what I'd found. I found something that really worked. See, what was going on for me, and I didn't know this, I was suffering from a condition before I ever picked up that drink, and I found out what it was when I came into AA in the doctor's opinion. And when he talks about alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontent, I was easily annoyed and never satisfied, and I didn't know that's what was going on. And when I took that drink treated that condition. And I remember the thought that I had was, I want to do that as much as I possibly can. And I proceeded to do that as much as I possibly could. And so you could basically, you know, fast forward my story. I'm 18 years old. I wake up one morning, and it's really not fair to say that I woke up. It's more like I came to, and my eyes just popped open, and immediately I knew where I was. And I'm lying on a bed, and the bed has belts on it, and I look at the door, and there's an orderly sitting there, and he's watching me, and I know where I am. I start having this memory. And the memory is, I'm sitting with this nurse, and she's doing some sort of interview. It was like an intake or outtake, whatever it was. And she said, she asked me, she goes, "Do you know why you're in here?" I said, "Yeah, I know why I'm in here. You know, a series of bad mistakes and misunderstandings, wrong place, wrong time, outside issues, non-conference approved materials, bad luck. You know, all, like the whole litany of BS that we give to people when they ask us why we're in the jackpot that we're in." And she says, or she asked me, she goes, "What about alcohol?" And I go, "What about alcohol? Alcohol's not the problem. Didn't you hear me? I just told you what the problem is." And she said, she asked me, she goes, "When you leave here, are you going to drink?" And I go, "Absolutely, I'm going to drink." I mean, that was like the dumbest question I'd ever heard. And I'll never forget this because I'm lying in this bed. And for some of you older people, you might remember this. There used to be this thing called the ABC After School Special. And it was almost like an after school special because I could see her face like floating above me, like right here, as she said these words to me. She goes, "I'm going to tell you something. If you leave here and you drink, I don't care if it's 10 years from now, 5 years from now, or a year from now, you're going to end up back here or in a place like this." And I laughed in her face because I thought she was being melodramatic. And here I am, I'm lying in this bed, and I know exactly where I am. I'm in that place. And the sad thing is, it's not 10 years later, 5 years later, or a year later. It's like 3 months later. And I'm like, I don't understand how she could have known that. You know what I mean? I was so, like, it was eerie that she could know that I was going to be back there. I mean, I felt like she had ESP, and I was like, this is crazy. Red flag goes up. Ominous warning that I failed to heed. And I tell you about that episode because that was the episode that would get me into Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. It was 1993. I was 19 years old. And I didn't come into AA because I wanted to get sober. I came in here because I was trying to get the heat off. And something happened to me at my third AA meeting. I met a guy. He gave me my first big book. I got my first sponsor. The only way I can describe it is at that third meeting, I had a spiritual experience. And I knew that, somehow I knew that if I kept coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going to be okay. I just knew it. And it was an amazing time. I wish that I could stand up here and tell you that I stayed sober from that time to this day. But that's just not my story. My story was... My first round in Alcoholics Anonymous lasted 7.5 years. And those first 5 years were amazing. I mean, there was a real transformation in my life. I went through the steps. I lived by spiritual principles. I got involved in general service. I was a GSR. I was a DCM. I mean, I did all the things that you're supposed to do to be a good AA member. And then something happened in my story that happens to a lot of us. I moved. And it wasn't that I moved that far because I was still in New York, but I moved far enough where I needed to find a new home group. And the problem was my first home group was the greatest home group in AA. I mean, that's a fact. You cannot disprove that. It was the best. And I'm looking for a new group, and they just, none of the groups I'm going to do it right, you know? None of them. They don't do it right. And the thing about it is, like, when you tell them that they're not doing it right, they never listen. They never do. They just kind of scowl at you. I join a group and I start thinking, I have this delusion in my head that now that I'm, you know, 5 years away from my last drink, man, there's no way I'm ever going to pick up a drink again. I don't need as much help as I used to need. I'm all right, you know? Maybe I don't need to talk to a sponsor that much. Maybe I don't need to sponsor guys that much. Maybe I don't need to be involved in general service like I used to. I could just go to meetings. And something happened to me that happens to a lot of people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in the rooms and I was getting sicker and I didn't know it. I did not know it. I'm going into the weeds and I don't know it. And I'm not talking to guys that will call me out on my stuff and I don't know it. So when the day finally came when I picked up the drink again, the experience was this. And the first thought that I had when I picked up that drink again was, man, I should have did this years ago. What was I thinking? Like it was really like being reunited with the love of my life. It was amazing. And shortly after that, the next thought was, maybe within a day or two, oh my God, what did I do? I unleashed the monster. See, I suffer from a condition that once I start drinking, I'm bodily and mentally, I mean, different from other people. I cannot stop on my own power. You know, I have a body that once I put the alcohol in my system, I cannot stop drinking. And once I stop, I can't stay stopped. And that's where I find myself. So from that time until the time I came back to AA, I was separated from alcohol for the last time on January 1st of 2007. And so in those years between that relapse and coming back, there were periods of sobriety and there were periods of drunkenness, but I was never again able to find what I'd once found in AA, right? Being happy, joyous, and free, feeling comfortable in my own skin, couldn't find it. I had a lot of anger, a lot of cynicism. I'm doing it my way. And of course, I would always pick up the drink again. And so the end for me looked like this before I came back this last time. There was once a time in my drinking where I could still have that false bravado, like I was the man and I could believe it. And I'll tell you I'm the man and you better believe it. And I could run around acting like everything's okay. But at the end of my drinking, there was this period for a while where all those illusions were gone and I could really see how pathetic I'd become. And it was scary. And it messed with my mind a little bit because I started thinking, had I been this pathetic the whole time? What's happened to me? My life had gotten so small. I could only do the bare minimum, if that. And life was becoming increasingly impossible. And so finally I got to the point where I said, I know what I have to do. I know what my problem is. I learned it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I'm bodily and mentally different from normal drinkers. I know what the solution is. The solution is spiritual in nature. And I know where to find that solution in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew all of those things. But see, the thing is, the book doesn't say lack of knowledge. That's our dilemma. It says lack of power. And I don't have the power, even though I have the knowledge, to fix myself or will myself to be better. And so what eventually happened for me was I was coming back to you. I had made a decision. I'm coming back to AA. I have to. And the decision was I was going to come back on January 1st because January 1st of a new year, that seems like a perfect day to get sober. It's a brand new day, brand new year. It's clean, right? Like, that's very clear thinking. When I came up with that date, it was probably like December 3rd or something like that, you know. I'm hurtling towards January 1st, acting like I have power over when I'm going to stop drinking, right? That's the delusion, that I have some say-so in this. And what happened to me, the scary thing about January 1st was New Year's Eve. And it was my last night, and I'm coming to you tomorrow. I'm coming back to you tomorrow, right? But the thing was this. Before tomorrow came, I found myself on the floor being resuscitated, surrounded by EMTs, paramedics, police officers, and I didn't know what happened. And they're telling me, hey, buddy, you're lucky to be alive. You know, you swallowed your tongue, your lips were blue. If she hadn't called us, you'd be dead. And once again, something had intervened in my life and death. Something else came and intervened for me. And this was, for me, my blessing in disguise, because this seemed like the worst possible thing to happen. Because here I am feeling like the biggest loser, like the biggest lowlife in the world. I can't even die. You know, I can't even die. And it reminded me, I used to hear this in the rooms of AA a lot, usually from old timers. And I hear something like this. If I go out and drink tonight, there's no guarantee I'll come back. I could die. And I would think, oh, God, you're so dramatic. You're not going to die, you know? And here I am. My plan was to come back to you. And there I was, dead. And it was just, it floored me. It was like the last illusions that I had some power over this deal. And on my way to that hospital, I just said, you know what? I will do whatever it takes to never feel this way again. That was it, man. I will do whatever it takes to never feel this way again. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sought out somebody that could take me through the steps again. And it was a process. I want to say one of the things that one of the things that plagued me and haunted me in those early days was I would think, God, like, it didn't make sense that I survived. You know what I mean? Like, it really, in my mind, it made a lot more sense that I should have died that night than lived. And it was like plaguing me. Like, what happened? Why? Why am I still here? You know, I got to tell you, today I don't have that question anymore because I know what my purpose is. You know, my purpose in life is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me, and that's the truth. And the fact that a guy like me, a selfish, self-centered, inconsiderate guy like me, could stand up here today and say that to you is miraculous. Because I did not come into AA thinking about who can I help. I did not care about helping you. When people said that I was going to have to help people, it made my skin crawl. I don't want to help. I don't want to help. I don't. Now, if you want to help me, that's great. You can help me all you want. Because I'm a taker. I'm not a giver. You know what I mean? And what I found out here is that this program is about, how do you take people who are takers and how do you transform them into givers? How does that happen? Right? The first 11 steps prepare us for that. Right? They make that transformation possible. In the last few minutes before that I have left, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like today for me. I on a daily basis, I'm living in steps 10, 11, and 12. You know, I do a nightly review. I review my day every single day. I inventory myself. I make amends if I have to make amends. I am going to be getting married this year, which is, that's that's amazing. My wonderful, beautiful fiance, she's here today. And you know, I lived the life of, you know, like a bachelor. I didn't think that it was ever going to happen for me, that's for sure. I have a, it's Father's Day. Happy Father's Day to all the fathers. I have a 19-year-old daughter who just this year moved to Chicago. And she is just, you know, she's got two alcoholic parents. And thank God, so far, so good. But she's got a genetically speaking, she's swimming in some dangerous waters there. But so far, so good. And I couldn't be prouder of her. You know, she's just an amazing person. And so this program has given me the ability to show up in relationships today, show up in my relationship with my daughter, show up in my relationship with my fiance, with my family, going through the process of amends and seeing how, you know, with family members, you know, there were things that I did that were just so damaging. There was so much damage that I caused that I could never see. And this has given me that ability to go back to those people and make reparation and make changes and see our relationships heal. And that's tangible. That's tangible results. The other day, I'm cleaning up my my bookshelf, and I come across a couple books, and I'm looking at them, and I go, where did I get these books? And suddenly I remember I had stolen those books from my high school library in like the 90s sometime. And I'm like, oh geez, I guess I have to make that amends. And so I call them up. I call up my high school and I get the library on the phone and I say, listen, I have some books of yours. I was a student in the 90s, and she's like, what do you mean? And I said, well, listen, either I'd like to return the books or I'd like to pay you for the books, and you know, and I'm giving her the whole spiel. And she starts laughing, and she's like, why are you doing this? And she doesn't know my life depends on it, you know? It seems like such a stupid thing, you know, but like my life depends on me being clear and clean in every area of my life, making restitution wherever I can. Even if it's something as stupid as like 20 some odd years later, I realized that I stole some books that I didn't realize I'd stolen, right? Make it right. So then I call up my sponsor and I go, okay, I have two options. I could mail him a check, which is what I want to do. I just want to do it easy. Or I can drive in. I'm going to have to, you know, take some time off work and drive in. And he says, yeah, you probably should drive in there. Like, all right. I got my marching orders. So I'm going to miss some work, and I'm going to go in, and I'm going to return those books. And that's the way this thing works, right? I'm here because I've totally screwed up my life. I'm here because I really don't know what's right for me. I need to bounce things off of other people. And on the flip side of that, you know, I work with guys today. Man, I just look at these people sitting across from me, and they are me, and I am them. And they're in all different phases of alcoholism. They're in all different phases of life, and they're broken people. And we sit together, and we read the book, and we go through the steps. And guess what? No matter what they do, no matter if they drink or they get sober, that's not up to me. I'm there to be there for them, to be a witness for them. And whether what I'm doing helps them, it doesn't matter. It helps me. I saw that I was the kind of guy that didn't have a lot of compassion for people. I didn't care about what you were going through. And today, by working with other people, I started to realize, like I said, I am them, they are me. I used to be the kind of guy, I don't want to hear your nonsense. Just do it. And today it's different for me. And once again, this is a miraculous program. I want to thank you for the life that you gave me. You know, there are people in here that I've known for years, and there's people that I don't know. And whether I know you or not, there's some way, shape, or form you did something that affected my life, and you made it possible. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Where are we here? Graylin's still an alcoholic. All right. Now, please help me welcome our second speaker, Rebecca P.
Hi, my name's Rebecca, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. It is so amazing to be standing up here right now, and this is the last place I ever expected to be at any point in my life. I want to thank Coco, the committee, and everybody that put in all the hard work in here. You know, thank you, Bill W. and Dr. Bob. You know, my sponsor, Tony Z, always says, you know, he makes fun of people that say don't leave until the miracle happens. You know, we're all here and the miracle's already happened. You know, I'm looking back at so much love in this room. I promised myself I wasn't going to cry, and I was sitting up here crying already because I have so many faces, you know, that have supported me to get me to where I am today. My sobriety date is November 23rd, 2014, so I just passed my 18 months. It took me 20 years to get here. I went to my first meeting 20 years ago. You know, and I went into the room, and I knew back then that something was wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was. And, you know, I went to meetings, and, you know, I was like, this isn't for me, you know. I think I need a transition. I need a situational change, you know. And at the ripe age of 19, I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to move to Manhattan. And not just Manhattan. I'm going to move to Washington Heights, and I'm going to become a bartender, and I'll show them. And I did, you know. I had my first drink probably about the age of 12. You know, I used to play bartender when I was younger for my family with my dad playing cards and stuff. And I suppose I always romanced the drink to a certain extent, you know. I don't think anything ever happened in my life that made me an alcoholic. I think it's just something that happened, just the way that I am, you know. But it's my responsibility, knowing that now, to get closer to God, to help other people to become recovered and stay the way that I am, you know. When I talk about being recovered, you know, it's not that I'm not an alcoholic anymore. It's about being recovered from the hopeless state of mind and body that alcohol puts me in, you know. And I maintain that by following the spiritual principles with inside of the big book. I apologize. I'm so nervous. You know, and I was able to find a group. I was able to find a group of people that had the working knowledge of the book, and they were working it themselves to show me how it had to be done, you know. I didn't come in here a winner by any means. About a week before my sober date, I had decided it was time to get sober for the final time. I was already suffering from alcohol dependency for about a year. You know, my life was surrounded by alcohol. I was hiding liquor in the house on myself, and I lived alone, you know. you know, because I didn't want drunk me to go looking in all the hiding places, because I had to have that liquor in the morning to steady myself to walk my son to school, you know. I mean, I literally, like, you know, I would have to bang on neighbors' doors if I ran out of liquor, because my shakes were so bad that I couldn't even walk myself to the 3 liquor stores that I went to, you know. I used to push my son in his stroller to the liquor store and think that they didn't know what was going on, because I rotate the liquor stores, right? Like it's totally natural for, you know, a single female with a kid to be buying, like, you know, a liter of vodka every 3 days, even if that's it, you know. And, you know, I just have to thank God again that I'm just standing here. I mean, when I came into the rooms, all I wanted to do was stop drinking. I hated all of you. I wanted nothing to do with any of you. I didn't want to go to meetings, but I lived in meetings because I had to, because I didn't have any steps yet in my life. And I would sit there and I would hate on everybody, you know, and thank God the meetings were there until I was able to find the program itself and work the steps, you know. The back of the book talks about, you know, the spiritual experience, and I was not looking for any sort of spiritual experience. I was just looking to get my son back. You see, I detoxed at home, and my detox was so bad that I fell into seizures and I was hallucinating. Mm-hmm. And although my son was in the custody of my ex-husband at the time, I hallucinated seeing my son on the couch and he wasn't breathing. And, you know, and to me that was a spiritual intervention in the strangest of ways, because I ended up calling up 911. And when they got there, I was convulsing on the floor and dying. Yeah. And I went into White Plains Hospital, you know. And, you know, they didn't bring me into the psych ward like how they usually do with the crazies. They're hallucinating and talking to walls and stuff, because my heart rate was so, you know, off the wall that they had to control it. You know, they had to moderate me for almost a good week just to make sure that I wasn't going to die on them, you know. And, you know, I've read back through the reports and, like, you know, I bit a nurse. I can't even tell you what that amends was like, going back to that hospital and trying to find a woman that I bit a year ago. You know, I fought a security guard, you know, I mean, like, all these crazy things, you know. And after I was released, you know, I went to go pick up my son, and I was served with an order of protection from my ex-husband, you know, for my alcoholism. And I was like, I don't understand, like, the alcohol's out of my system, like, I beat it. Like, really, don't you people understand? Like, everything is okay now. Like it's good. Like, I don't have to drink anymore, you know? And I went to the police station, and I was served with more paperwork saying that they were asking for full custody and for me to relinquish my rights. And, you know, every ounce of self-willpower, every ounce of knowledge that I had, you know, just went out the window. And, you know, with my hospital badges still on, I went directly to the liquor store and I bought another bottle. And I drank for the next 24 hours, and I could not get drunk, you know, and I tried. I drank, trust me, I tried, you know. And, you know, I went to a meeting the next day, and, you know, and I was met with all of you guys, you know. In my first 90 days, I lost my apartment, I got evicted, I lost my son, I lost my job, and I was like, and I couldn't handle hearing anything about God or a higher power or anything like that, because if there was anything working in my life, then what was going on? You know, here I am trying to do the right thing, and nothing is working out, and I don't know why, you know. And I put down the drink, and everybody's telling me once I put down the drink, life is going to improve, you know, but I'm still waking up with the terrors and the shakes and the fear, and nothing seems to be going right, you know. And fortunately, you know, I started working the steps, like I said, and it was explained to me, you know, what an alcoholic was, you know, that I can't drink like normal people. You know, once I get it in my system, I'm off to the races, and there's no stopping me. If I'm not drinking, you know, in the dry drunk state that I was, going to meetings and not doing anything and not changing, having that psychic change that I needed, you know, I'm still the old person. You know, I'm still living in resentment and terror and fear and everything else. And, you know, and I didn't do that, and I was almost suicidal. I couldn't understand why. I felt like I was doing all the right things, and it just wasn't happening, you know? You know, and again, I went back to, you know, to the spiritual experience in the back, and it talks about, you know, contempt prior to investigation. And, you know, and I really, really, you know, had to go over, like, you know, we agnostics and everything, you know, and I was told, like, all you need to do is open up that door just a little bit, just to let the sunlight of the Spirit in, you know? And I really didn't want to, and, you know, for a while there, I used the rooms as my higher power. I used my son because that was the only tangible thing that I had in my life, you know? I didn't get to see my son for the first 100 days of my sobriety. No phone calls, no contact, no nothing. I mean, I can't tell you the dry drunk rage that I was in. I can't even believe that anybody even picked me up because I was angry at everybody and everything, you know? You know, and so I ended up going through the steps and, you know, and I had to take a good look at myself and do an inventory, you know, and look at how many people I wronged, you know, and I realized, you know, the book talks about how, like, you know, we either need to find a spiritual solution or continue blotting out the existence of what we're doing, you know? And that was me over and over again, you know, whether it was, you know, having good times in the city, you know, and so one time I'm in the city and I was just talking about this the other day and I'm waiting for the PATH train to go back to Jersey City where I'm now attending law school, you know. I'm about a month from dropping out. And this was back in the day. I'm reapplying to law school now. This is like 10 years ago, so don't clap now. I've already dropped out that round. So I'm waiting for the PATH train, and it goes by. And so I'm like, you know, it's another hour. Let me have a couple more shots, you know. So I go back up, have a couple more shots. I repeat this about four more times like you do over the next couple hours. And, you know, the next thing I know, I wake up to a cop kicking my foot. And he's like, you know, what are you doing? And I said some really inappropriate things that you should not say to an authority, you know. And I ended up in handcuffs and brought to a hospital for detox. And so I took myself a nice little nap, and I woke up, and my phone was dead, and my shoes were gone. And I was in little plastic handcuffs, and I'm like, well, that was great. Like, I had, like, an awesome, like, power nap. Like, I'm ready to go, you know. And they're like, no, like, you have to be arraigned. Like, you know, like, you were drunk and disorderly and this and that. We have to monitor you. And I was like, I don't have time for this. I got to walk my dog. I got to go to work. This is just, no. This ain't on my schedule, you know. And so I wait for them to call a code, for, you know, for somebody that actually, like, had, like, you know, a real health problem, not like me, you know. And they went running to the other side, and I grabbed my purse barefoot, and I ran out the door. And it's New York City on the Lower East Side. I just jumped in a cab. They didn't ask questions, you know. So I pay $80 to take a cab barefoot, chew off the plastic bracelets, right, you know, and show up at my local bar, the Astor Bar at the time in Jersey City, and I'm like, you guys will never believe what just happened to me. Pour me a drink. You know? And that was the good times. I mean... You know, so I started hanging out with people that were working the solution, you know. I remember going to the Falcha anniversary, and this girl from the Bronx, Danielle T., came and picked me up. And, you know, she was a little wild and crazy, and I was a little bit reserved about her. But let me tell you, that girl is pretty amazing. She came, and we baked, and we did, like, you know, all that kind of stuff and got cookies together, you know. And I was still pretty broke, so, like, I would, like, hoard cookies at the end of the meetings to take home, you know. And she's like, listen, she's like, you're going to come with me after, and I'm going to show you what AA is really about. And I'm like, ooh, I don't know about this. And, you know, and sure enough, we go, and all the food that's left over, we start distributing to the homeless outside. And, you know, and I've got, like, my little, like, you know, box of cookies, and I'm not going to lie, I didn't want to give them up, you know. I was like, wait a minute, you know, like, I'm all about giving, but not my cookies, no. You know, and you know, and I did, and I felt like, you know, and I felt that power, you know, and that's what this program is all about. This program is about helping each other. You know, the book says we have to be a good Samaritan every single day. You know, that, you know, it's not just about, you know, helping each other, like, you know, through the book, which of course is alcoholics. That's what I have to do to maintain my sobriety. I need my sponsees more than they need me. You know, I get to walk side by side with them, and every time I work with somebody else, I get to learn something new. You know, and they teach me to be a better person every day, you know. You know, and I had to go through my steps, and I had to make amends, you know. And, you know, part of my amends was going up to people that weren't even prepared to see me. You know, I got a call to do a bartending job in sobriety because as a recovered alcoholic, you know, the urge is removed, and I can do whatever it is I need to do, you know. So as a recovered alcoholic, I went and I bartended Mardi Gras down in Galveston, Texas. And that paid for a round-trip ticket for me to do face-to-face amends with family members. That's how God works. I mean, this is not anything that I could ever plan, you know, whatsoever. Anytime I try to plan, you know, that's how I ended up here, you know. And so I ended up going to Texas, and, you know, I saw my mother, and she had, you know, and she told me, she said, you know, part of it is saying, you know, like, is there anything that you want to say to me? You know, what can I do to you? Because I don't know everything that I did to you, you know. And she said to me, you know, Rebecca, it's the fact that when the phone rings, you know, when the phone used to ring, I didn't know if you were dead or alive. She was like, you robbed me of my peace, you know. And I thought because I was like, you know, this big girl in the city and putting myself through college and taking care of myself and, you know, states away that I wasn't affecting anybody. You know, and we don't realize we're like this boulder that gets dropped in the lake and it just ripples out, you know. And, you know, and my mom said, you know, she was like, you know, I accept your amends, but I just can't be around you right now. You know, and that hurt. You know, but part of being in this program is respecting where other people are. You know, it's not my job to force myself upon you because I've been doing that long enough, you know. And I heard from other family members that I didn't even realize I had any impact on, you know, that they had been hurt. You know, from the repercussions, you know, people had carrying their own resentments because of my actions and stuff, you know, and just ways I didn't even realize I had hurt people. You know, and when I came back, you know, I went to my sponsor and I said, you know, this isn't how it's supposed to go. No. You know, and I said, I don't understand, like, you know, what was the lesson in this? Like, you know, I went there and, like, you know, I want to make everything good. Like, I want to feel good about this, you know, like, I want to connect to God and I want to get the power, you know. And he said to me, you know, Rebecca, sometimes it's about forgiving other people and not just about being forgiven. And he said, maybe you should look at your life and see who you're not forgiving. And, you know, and I did. And, you know, I have a biological father that I hadn't spoken to in maybe 20 years. You know, and he's the pastor of a church up in Chicago. And, you know, coming from my atheist and, like, you know, hating God perspective, he was like, oh, my goodness, no. You know? And, you know, and because of that, you know, I was like, you know what, if this is what God wants me to do, you know, because that's what this program taught me, you know, is that, like, you know, even though I was terrified coming up here, like, I got to come up here. Like, I got to show up. I got to do this, you know? If not, you know, I got to do this because God gave me this gift of sobriety so that I can come and help other people because that's all that it is about anymore, you know? And so I was able to call him up and say, you know, everything that's happened in the past, you know, I forgive you. You know, and he cried and he was like, you know, can I get on a plane? And I was like, yeah, not yet. You know? But we're slowly building upon a relationship, and that's what it is. It's about you know, repairing the wreckage of my past. You know, when I came out of that hospital, like I said, all I wanted to do was get my son back, and I didn't understand why nobody else understood that. You know, like, I'm a full-time mother. Like, you know, I put him in a responsible place. You know, I cut the alcohol from my life, and why can't everything just be okay, you know? And I cursed whatever was out there because I didn't understand why all these things were happening, you know? I got evicted from my home 3 months in. You know, I was couch hopping and going all over, you know? And it's just amazing how when you let go and you let God take over and work through you, how things work out, you know? I had, I ended up going into an outpatient called St. Vincent's. You know, and I did it for court, you know, I was mandated and everything, and, you know, it was great. They taught us different ways to say no, you know, because that was always my issue. I just didn't know how to say no, like passively, no, you know, or angrily, no, I don't want to drink, you know, like that was the issue. And, you know, because I went there, I ended up meeting somebody who got me a job, and, you know, and I had, like, you know, some other tax papers that I, you know, that I didn't think I was going to get back, and because, I end up getting evicted, I end up getting, like, a bigger tax refund. And how that works out is just God. I mean, that's not anything I could have ever planned, but it was all these little things, you know, that just kept adding up in my life, and I was like, oh, my goodness, like, these things are horrible, you know, but I can't see the big picture, you know, and thank goodness I can't because I probably mess it up, you know. And, you know, and again, you know, my favorite part of the book, you know, the spiritual experience, it talks about contempt prior to investigation. You know, and that was a big part for me. You know, I didn't want to know anything about a higher power. You know, it was all, I got this. I don't want to rely upon you. You know, just get me to a meeting so I can get my paper signed and I'll be good. you know, and the power that I feel today is just absolutely amazing. I mean, I can't believe that I haven't cried up here yet, you know, but, you know, today I have my son back in my life. I've shared custody with my son. You know, I'm able to work and I show up without the shakes and I show up without a bottle of vodka in my purse. You know, I show up without thinking, you know, that I'm a good person because I'm not stealing from you today, because I've robbed pretty much every job that I've ever had. I mean, you know, bartending is kind of, was a perfect job for me. You know, alcohol was king and I got to serve it. I mean, you know. But today, you know, I get up and it's like, you know, the terror, the bewilderment, the fear. You know, I still have, like, you know, minor anxieties, but, you know, like, the fact that I don't wake up wanting to die every single day like how I was, it was like a Groundhog horror movie, just every day. You know, the disease had me, like, before I even opened up my eyes, it was just holding me, you know, and I would open up my eyes and thank God, not again, you know. And today I can wake up and I can turn my life over and I can say, God, please help me be useful. Please show me what I can do. Show me somebody that I can help, you know. And, you know, and it's fun. It's become, like, almost like a game, like being the Good Samaritan and, like, looking for people, you know, to help, doors to hold, you know. I'm hoping I find a couple more people to work with here today, you know. But I don't know. I know that I have a couple more minutes up here, and I'm not quite sure what to say. I'm just honestly so grateful. You know, I get to be a mother today, you know. I get to be a better mother than I ever was when I was drinking before I went through this program. You know, I can actually be there and look him in the eyes. I can look my family in the eyes and I can look myself in the eyes. You know, and I don't have to get up in fear anymore because I've gone through these steps and I work this program and I carry this message, you know, and I walk with God and I walk side by side with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. This has been an amazing meeting so far. And now we're going to take a 10-minute break, okay? So y'all stretch your legs and don't forget to come back now. You hear? Speaker, our final speaker. Spencer P.
Hi, everybody. I'm Spencer. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Spencer.
Woo! I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here with you guys today. And what a meeting. This has been unbelievable. John, I mean, just unbelievable. Thank you. Rebecca, you knocked it out of the park. It was unbelievable. Good job. Yeah, so I get a little, people say, you know, oh, do you get nervous to speak? I said, no, I'm nervous that I only have 20 minutes. You know what I mean? I mean, that's what I'm nervous about. I'm nervous that there's not enough people and that I don't have enough time. You know, because there is so much that I want to tell you. Like, there is so much that I want to tell you. What has happened to me between today and June 11th of 2006, which is the time that I had my last drink? So last weekend was 10 years of continuous sobriety. And what has happened between that day and this day? I mean, like, how do you even tell? How do you even describe that to somebody? It sounds like science fiction. You know what I mean? It sounds like make-believe. I'm like, my whole world is different. People are like, well, you still have the same family. You still have the same, like, you still, like, same pant size, you know? I'm like, no, but, like, everything is different. Everything. And part of the reason I think that these meetings are so extraordinary is because we get the opportunity to play show and tell. You know, we get the opportunity to see somebody with a year and a half of sobriety, somebody with 8 or 7 or 6 or 20 years of sobriety come up and share what their life used to be like. You know, and what their life is like now. And it's just so extraordinary. I mean, one of the things that has made AA such a special place for me is to really to witness the transformations that have happened. I mean, just to bear witness to, like, what I have seen happen to you. And in turn, what's happened to me has just been extraordinary. So I'll start you guys off with my last drunk. I know you all love a good story. So I come, I'm butt naked. I'm standing in the Uniontown prison shower, right? Y'all probably been there. And they're spraying me down with a garden hose, and I'm covered in delousing powder. It's kind of like Ajax, you know? And I'm not totally clear on how I've gotten there. You know, I mean, in retrospect, I'm able to kind of like, you know, I had some general ideas of how I might have ended up there. But in that moment, I remember being very surprised. And you know, they go through the whole thing. They put me in they prick your finger for the blood test and the orange jumpsuit, and they say fingerprints and the whole thing. They go through the whole deal. And so I had ended up in the Uniontown jail in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, because I had set out that morning to go on a whitewater rafting trip. And so y'all might be an alcoholic if you understand what it's like for somebody who woke up in the morning to go whitewater rafting and then ended up naked standing in the prison shower getting sprayed down covered in Ajax, right? The best laid plans. And so what had happened was that I had a lot to drink the night before, and that's an understatement. And then I'd woken up that morning, and I was still, you know, pretty drunk, and I was going on this whitewater rafting trip with my friends, and I got down to the river, and I was, you know, almost in a blackout. I was, like, really, really hammered, couldn't walk. I like really want to go on the river, and the guides that are running the trip are like, no, you can't go. Like, there's no way that this guy's so drunk. Like, there's no way that he's going to get in the river. And so I do the only thing that I could think of, which is I go like running into the river. You know, I'm like, no, like I'm going to go down the rapids on my own. So there I am, like swimming down the Housatonic. I don't know what river it was. And I'm like swimming down this river. And I, at the time, I had these big earrings and a mohawk that's like flopped over to the side. I'm like a wet rat, you know, just like going down the river. I'm probably not even close to the rapids, you know. It's like a swimming hole or something I'm in. And so the guide, they don't want me to die. Like it's on their, you know, on their watch. So they paddle out in a kayak and they throw me over the front of the kayak and they get me back to shore. And I was just not happy about it, you know. So I attacked him, and they did what I think is pretty normal thing. You know, they called the police, and the police came, and I wasn't having that, so I attacked the police officer, and they, you know, they put me in handcuffs and took me to jail. It was not the first time I'd been in handcuffs, but I had an experience that became, I think, clearer and clearer as time went on. But something happened to me while I was being walked down the gangplank to my cell, you know. And by the way, like, I don't want to over-dramatize my story. I was in jail for all of 8 hours, okay? So listen, don't make it sound, I like it to sound like I was a prisoner, you know what I mean? Like, I just, like a long sentence, you know, I got like a tattoo of a spider web on my, you know, like, I was literally there from like 10 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. That's it. That's like my entire experience of jail. But here I am, like, walking down to the cell because they're gonna put me in. It's a Saturday, so they have to wait for the judge and something else and my bail to post or whatever. And these guys are yelling, you know, like, it's not like a drunk tank. It's like where people who actually are serving some significant amount of time are spending, it's like 5 years, 8 years, whatever, that these people are spending time. And they're yelling out of the cell as I go past, like, Tomahawk! Tomahawk! I had the mohawk, right? So that was my jail nickname. Tomahawk! Tomahawk, what you in here for? And I'm like, and then the police officer said, oh, I think he might have said he bit a cop. I don't remember biting anybody. I mean, I believe it, but like, I maybe attacked the guy. Oh, like he went after the officer. And all I remember is the guy saying, Tomahawk, crazy! And, you know, that's about sums it up. So that's my story. Anyways, here we are in AA. So I have this moment, right, when I'm walking down the thing in the tomahawk, and I'm walking down, and the You know, there was like this idea that I had, and maybe some of you can relate to this, that I was so surprised that I was there because, you know, I just thought that I could like talk some sense into, like now that I understood why they brought me to jail. Do you know what I mean? Like, I get it. Like, I was disorderly, I was drunk, but now I've kind of started to sober up, so I don't understand why they're keeping me in jail. You know, like, that's the part. I get why you brought me here. It was a misunderstanding. Like, you thought that I was, you know, a maniac, you know, and a threat to society. And, like, now that I'm sobering up, like, we can certainly talk like adults and kind of clear this up. You know, because I think at that point in my life, like, I believed that there were two different jails. Like, I thought that there was a jail for bad people that did bad things, and then a whole nother category for people like me who had accidentally done bad things when they were drinking. You know, because I was only ever judging myself on my intentions. My intentions were so good. Like, I got up that day just to have fun and, like, go on the river, you know? And that's what always happened with alcohol, you know, that my life was, I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. And so, you know, I got to AA. I didn't run into AA with open arms. I looped around the block. And I couldn't find a parking space. Right, so I would like drive past me. I'd be like, well, I don't know. I can't find a parking space. Never, not once in my entire life did I ever not find a parking space at a liquor store or a bar. I would have parked on the sidewalk. But like this AA meeting, I'm like, no, I don't know. Like, I don't see, look, I can't read that sign that might say 7 p.m. I don't want to get a ticket. As if somehow like all of the tickets that I had paid in my entire life, you know, were not worth getting me to that one moment. But I had, so I circled the block on my first one. I finally got to the first AA meeting that I went to. I was sitting in the back corner, and I was next to this guy who was eating a bagel sandwich out of this, like, the noisiest tinfoil wrapper. And I just, like, couldn't stand this guy, you know? Like, I just couldn't believe that, like, this is where my life had ended up. You know, with this, like, tinfoil guy and, like, I mean, it was just the worst. But then at the end of the meeting, everybody held hands and said, it keeps coming back. It works if you work it. And I felt something. You know, like I felt something that was sort of as subtle, as soft as it was. There was like something there. There was something that made me feel like I was a part of this group. But I still wasn't convinced. So my second AA meeting, I went to a women's meeting. And I'm going to tell you something. I know I look like a lady, but they did not let me in. And that is one of the most important things that ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I really believed that I had a different set of rules. I really did. I really thought that whatever rules you had didn't apply to me. And I thought, especially in that first like week that I was coming into AA, I really thought certainly now, I mean, I know the rules didn't apply to me before, but now they apply to me even less. Because I have this past, because I'm doing something so extraordinary, like the gift of my sobriety that I'm giving to you. Like, of course, these desperate losers in AA are going to want me at their meeting. I don't care if it's a W in the book. I don't need to pay attention to that kind of stuff. And these ladies stood there at the door, and they were like, yeah, no, you can't come in. And I was like, well, what am I supposed to do? And they're like, well, you could find another meeting. And I've been grateful for 10 years. I've been grateful to those women because I think that's such an extraordinary gift. You know that we are given. You know, there are no rules in AA, but we have traditions that we follow, and we have the ability to hold those traditions and participate in this thing with each other, with love and with kindness and with boundaries. And that was none of those things were things that I had when I came in here. But eventually, you know, I started to get into it. Like, I started to like AA. I certainly saw in you guys, I saw something that I wanted. You know, I saw this light and this life that I didn't have up until that time. But I was really confused about what AA was, you know. And I think what the problem was is that I was really confused about what alcoholism was, you know, because I thought I knew what alcoholism was. I mean, I thought I knew everything, which was part of the problem. But in particular, I thought I knew what alcoholism was. And I thought when it said powerless over alcohol, what I thought that meant was the experience that I'd had over and over again, which was that when I started drinking, I couldn't stop. Right? When I put booze into my system, it was like this magnet had been turned on inside of me, and it pulled me with this force that was beyond words. This force pulled me towards the next drink. Right? Like there was just nothing that was going to get in the way of me having my next drink. So that's what I thought it meant to be powerless. And, you know, it turns out that that is part of powerlessness. That is a huge part of powerlessness, right? That I have a physical allergy to alcohol, that when I start drinking, I can't stop. But the thing is, what was pointed out to me by you guys is that that's not my only problem. Because if that was my only problem, that when I start drinking, I can't stop, there's a really easy solution to that problem. Don't start. Just don't start drinking. Right? So my problem as an alcoholic is not just that I can't stop once I start. My problem is that sober, totally sober, with not a drop of alcohol in my body, I am unable to bring into my mind with sufficient force the memory of what alcohol has done to me in the past. I have no defense against the first drink. I knew that I didn't have a defense against all the other drinks, right? I knew that. I knew I had no defense against 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I mean, I knew that. I would start drinking, and then I would just keep drinking. But I always just assumed that I could control whether or not I had the first drink. And yet, when I looked back at my life, what I looked back on, right, was time and time and time and time and time and time again, where knowing everything that I knew about alcohol and what it was going to do to me, I still picked up a drink. That's insanity. Right? I was with my soon-to-be sister-in-law. I'm getting married, too. We're getting married, like, right in the, like, almost the same month. Thank you. I think you should actually clap for him. It's not really something. He's the one that has had the great accomplishment in this, is being in a relationship with an alcoholic. So, but you know, this idea of powerlessness, right, and that I thought, right, that with everything that I knew about what alcohol had done to me, I thought that I would be able to stop myself from drinking. And yet, when I look back at my life, all I found was examples of times when I should have not taken a drink, and I did. Right? So what I was going to tell you, my soon-to-be sister-in-law, she was a hard partier in college, and she's kind of nuts and wild. And so she's her and I are talking, and she's telling me this crazy story, and it's about, like, ending up in the hospital and blah, 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 blah. And I said, oh, my God, like, I had that same thing happen to me. Right? And she goes, like, oh, well, you know, am I an alcoholic, you think? And I was like, I don't know. Did it ever happen to you again? She was like, no. And I was like, then probably not, right? Because when I ended up at 17 in the hospital with the IVs in my arms and blood on my face and my mom's at the end of the bed crying, right, I should have learned from that experience. And yet, there I was, again, the IVs in the bed and my mom standing at the end of the bed crying. Like, that experience has not happened to me once in my life. That experience has happened over and over again, right? Because I don't learn a lesson from alcohol, right? There's a curious mental blank spot. I'm incapable of using my own mind to stop myself from drinking. And so the solution to that problem, which is presented to us in AA, is to find a power that can come and intervene in that moment between, like, maybe I should have a drink and that's a bad idea, right? Maybe I should have a drink and then I'm drinking the drink. Right? So what we're looking for in AA is we're looking for access to a power that is going to restore us to sanity. It's going to relieve that insane thing that comes in, right, in that moment where I think of alcohol and then I pick up the drink. And what I have found, right, is that the access to that power comes to me as a result of working the program of AA. Right? Now see, I didn't when you guys said that, when you said, oh, your problem is powerlessness, what you need is a power, right? Thought like, well, okay, that's great. What's this power? Oh, it's God. No. Not a chance. Not a chance. Thank you. God is for weak people. I'm an intellectual. And the good news, right, for somebody like me, is that what was being asked of me in AA was not that I change my mind about God, right? It was not that I come to be able to define God or understand God or explain God. What was being asked of me in AA was simply that I follow the instructions that were given me and then see what happens. So I did, right? I got a sponsor, and I started writing my fourth step. I wrote all the, that's easy, like just write all the people you hate. Sure, no problem. Here's everybody I'm angry at. It gets harder as you go through the columns, but that first column is super easy, right? And so I go through the steps, and what happens to me, and I know that this has happened to most of you, or will happen to most of you. What happened was that as I went through the steps, I started to have an experience of God. Right? So it wasn't that my mind had changed. It was that my heart had been opened. Right? So what happened to me was that rather than having to think about God or understand God or explain God, I just felt the presence of a power greater than myself. I had an experience. I was transformed by the experience of God. And it wasn't something that I had to think my way into. But you know, there's another thing that happens once we have that experience, and I am very guilty of this, which is that I take the tool that I used to get the thing that I wanted, and then I twist it into a tool of self-will. Right? So what happened as a result of doing the steps and having this transformative experience is that I started to do the steps in order to get other things that I thought I really wanted. Right? So not to just have the experience of sobriety, but what I started to do was I started to do the steps in a way that could like, well, where's my car? You know, where's my relationship? Where's my better job? Where's my better house? And what I was trying to do was I was trying to separate myself from those disturbances, right? Like, can I put space between me and fear? Right? That's, we're almost like taught that. Like fear is a bad thing, and like the whole idea is to get free of the fear. But we get free of the fear by moving away from it. Right? That's how my whole operation was like, I got to get away from fear. Like fear is the bad thing that's away from me. And more and more and more, the thing that is starting to come into my mind is that I don't need to get away from fear. Because I am the thing that is capable of transforming the fear. So with God's power and through my heart, I'm actually capable of taking fear and transforming it into love. Right? It's like photosynthesis. Right? Like the leaves of the trees that take in the carbon and put out oxygen. That's what my heart is capable of doing. My heart is capable of taking fear, all the fear. Bring me your fear. Bring me all the fear in the world. Because it's not my machine that's doing it. It's not my self-will. It's not my self-reliance. It's not me that's transforming it. I'm the instrument. I'm the channel. That as a result of this program, as a result of working the steps, what's happened to me is that I have been made into this machine that can transform fear into love. What an opportunity we've been given. Who has time to drink? What an opportunity we've been given to spend our lives not just sober. Not just sober. That's what I thought. I thought that's what I was going to get. But I get to be a warrior of God's love. I get to go out into the world every day of my life. Every day of my life. And be a beacon of hope and love and peace and joy. That is a gift that I never knew that I wanted. I mean, how extraordinary. I heard a speaker one time that said, why is it that we despise those things which bring us to the feet of our Creator? Why is it that we despise those things which bring us to the feet of our Creator. My problem is not that I get agitated and ashamed and afraid and envious, because I get those things. My problem is that I think that they are a problem. They're not a problem. They're an opportunity. They're an opportunity to transform what we've been given into an extraordinary life, and not to take it for ourselves, but to share it. And I'm so grateful that that's what you've shared with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Spencer. And now we will hold the very moving sobriety countdown. Today, we will be giving a copy of the 75th anniversary of the Big Book to the person with the least amount of sobriety in the room today, and a copy to the person with the most years sober. Please help me welcome Grace O to lead us in this fun count of all the years of sobriety in this room. Woo!